And to begin this morning, Linda Bartlett will speak to us. She chairs the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Sanctity of Life Task Force. She is also the editor of Family Living, which is a magazine published by Lutherans for Life. And she also edits a publication entitled Paper Treasures, which is Christian resources for families. She is from Iowa Falls, Iowa, the heart of the Midwest, and she is married and has two children. So will you please welcome into our midst Linda Bartlett.
It is a privilege for me to be here with you today. I never expected, as a wife and mother, to be addressing seminary students. That was not something that I thought I would ever be doing, nor have I thought that I would be doing a lot of what God has placed in my life to do in the last 8 to 10 years. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a teacher. In fact, I have no initials behind my name, but as a dear pastor friend of mine recently said, Linda, you have the best education possible, and that is the word of the Lord. And with that wisdom, I stand before you, trying to learn more of what he has to say to us about the life issue. Imagine yourself standing in the crowd of people that King Ahab gathered around Elijah the prophet when Elijah said, "How long are you going to waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." And the people said nothing. Imagine yourself standing next to me as a pastor says, "Linda, we're throwing away our children in this country like so many paper cups through abortion." But then he looks at me and he said, "I've taken two of my own teenagers from my congregation to have abortions because I figured their parents would never be supportive of an unplanned pregnancy." And the people in his congregation say nothing. Imagine sitting on the ELCA task force on abortion where one member proclaims, "We should agree to disagree on the subject of abortion," and the people say nothing. Imagine reading a column written by one Methodist pastor who says that Methodists are neither pro-life or pro-choice. Does that mean they're neither for or against? And the people say nothing. What does God say? To the church at Laodicea, God says, "I know your deeds and that you are neither hot nor cold. I wish you were one or the other, but because you are only lukewarm, I am about to spit you out of my mouth." We have asked the people of this nation, "Do you believe abortion is wrong?" And they've answered, "Well, yes, I personally believe it's wrong, but I don't believe it's right to impose my morality on someone else." We've asked the people of this nation, "Do you believe it's wrong to take someone's life? Someone who is perhaps old or senile or handicapped?" And they've answered, "Yes, that's wrong, but I believe that everyone should have a quality life and a right to die." We've asked the people of this nation, "Do you believe that sex outside of marriage is acceptable?" And they've answered, "Well, yes, only if safe sex is practiced." We've asked the people of this nation, "Do you believe homosexuality is wrong?" And they have answered, "Well, it's not for me, but such people can't help who they are, and their rights should be protected." And we've asked the people of this nation, "Do you believe that God created the world and rules over it? And do you believe that men and women are accountable to God, that they are sinful?" And the people have answered, "Well, I suppose there might be a supreme being of some sort, but because we are all in the evolving process, we have everything within ourselves to become better and better." I think those of you who are studying to be pastors, those of us in congregations, those of us at work out in Christian communities know there's a separation taking place in society and also within our Christian churches. People will have to decide if they are going to follow God, stand with him and his eternally true word, or just merely drift along using personal choice and privacy as their guiding compass. And although we may not want to hear it, Scripture tells us that judgment does begin with the household of God. Abortion has become one of those issues that stirs deep emotions. You've already seen just how touchy it can be, maybe within your own family or with friends. Why is it that close to half of all the pregnancies are ended by women who have learned to see death as better than life, as abortion is better than birth, as an empty womb better than an expectant one? Why is it that those with a liberal persuasion, when faced with difficult human problems, often seem to formulate a solution ending in death? Whether it's a teen pregnancy, a Down syndrome baby, a comatose patient, or an elderly parent, the answer too often seems to be the same: death. Why is it that so many people willingly respond with such a hopeless and pessimistic solution to life's problems? Well, perhaps the answer is found in a series of myths which have become, unfortunately, the gospel of our present-day society, this humanistic society. Sadly, our children are being taught many of these myths in the school and through TV. The first myth is that life began with blind chance. Now, if we believe that man is just an accident, he's a fluke of nature, a mistake, then man has no value. The question that we should be asking is, why is it that evolution is so widely accepted? Well, one scientist recently said, the reason we did accept Darwin's theory of evolution as proof is because we didn't want God to interfere with our sexual values. So there you have it. That's one of the reasons why man does not want to believe in a God. He doesn't want any interference from the Creator. But without a Creator, there's no basis for right and wrong. There's almost virtually no way to distinguish between right and wrong. The second myth is that men and women can be like God, and I don't need to elaborate on this one. This is a thinking that we know came from Satan in the Garden of Eden. Humanism and the New Age movement are not new. And the third myth is that the roles of men and women are interchangeable. That's right, that's what I just said. I know that's not very popular thinking today. Equal rights sounds only fair. But behind such thinking is a great deception that's attacking motherhood and the family and society in general. Radical feminists, sometimes together with the homosexual community, believe that traditional marriage is an oppressor of women. They believe that in order to raise children with equality, we should take them away from traditional family structures. Now, Gloria Steinem, a longtime advocate of women's rights and abortion, says, and I quote, "By the year 2000, we will, I hope, raise our children to believe in themselves, not God." You can see where abortion has become the eroding force, chipping away at the foundation of the family. Abortion not only devalues the child, it devalues motherhood. If a preborn child is of so little value, then of what value can it be for a mom to stay at home and spend her time mothering a child of 3 or 5 or 10, let alone a burdensome adolescent? A lot of people view abortion as a liberation for women, but the fact is, abortion is often an encouragement for a father to evade long-term responsibilities. Rather than being a liberation for women, we see women being used for mere gratification and then encouraged to undergo the risks of abortion and the years of emotional trauma that often follow. Women are reduced to the status of a consumer item, which, if broken by pregnancy, can be fixed by abortion. When we look around and see the terrible things that are happening in our world, we should not be so surprised. Because what nation that does not take care of its children shall find peace? One woman who chose abortion as the solution to her problem said, "The abortion experience is just one more hardening of my heart. Hardening my heart to my own flesh conditions me to do it to others and even justifies it in my mind." What is it that makes a woman so willing to reject the baby growing so close to her own heart? It could be that there are three reasons. One is found in Psalm 2, where we are told that the peoples plotted in vain against the Lord, saying, "Let us break the chains that bind us." The second reason is that too few in our country, Christian Lutherans included, are willing to help others carry their burdens. In a survey of women who chose abortions, 63% said they felt forced by their boyfriends or counselors or pastors or parents or doctors to have an abortion. 45% to 61% said, while approaching the abortion clinic door, that they were still hoping for another option. All they wanted was for somebody to come up to them, take their hand, and say, "You don't have to do this. I'll stick with you during your 9 months of pregnancy. We'll get through this. I'll be there for you." More than 91% felt that their doctors or counselors did not help them explore their decisions. So because a boyfriend or a parent or a counselor, knowingly or unknowingly, failed to help through a difficult situation, one life was ended and another was wounded. The third reason that a woman rejects her unborn baby is because of the pressure placed on her by society. Today, motherhood is seldom glamorized. However, self-gratification and prestige and sexual freedom are glamorized. Pick up any woman's magazine and you'll see what I mean. Using the disguises of freedom and privacy and choice, Satan tempts men and women to do their own thing, whatever feels right. and if another human being, say a small unborn child, gets in the way, then that human being becomes the acceptable sacrifice necessary for a chosen lifestyle. Because the law of our land says that abortion is okay, these women who choose abortion aren't even allowed to grieve. It's as if our nation is saying, hey lady, you chose abortion, now live with it. We know that the quotes, the stories, the testimonies are starting to come in from many women across the country. Recently, there have been several articles written by Lutherans for Life members. One article is written by Reverend Ed Feskins, the executive director of Lutherans for Life. It was in The Witness about 2 years ago. The response to his article was amazing. One woman wrote, I thought I must be crazy because I couldn't shake the nightmares and the deep pain I felt about the loss of my child. When the Lord finally blessed me with a local Right to Life group, He gave me the support and the encouragement of others that brought me to such a place of peace and healing. But I still had a deep hurt that my church was not doing more to protect the unborn and save the mommies. Another woman says, sadly enough, the guilt that I have from my abortion has kept me from the one place I need most, the church. I feel drawn to Christ, but feel that what I have done is unforgivable. I can't let myself be forgiven, and I know I need help. I am a confirmed Lutheran, but I don't feel that my pastor would be of much help to me at this time. And finally, a letter from a 95-year-old woman who had her abortion over 50 years ago, who writes, when I read your article on abortion, I felt I could speak to someone about my terrible sin at last. I did confess my adultery and fornication to my pastor at that time, but I did not tell him about the abortion. I feel terribly upset over the sin, and I wonder, can I ever be forgiven? Will God ever accept me for this sin that I have done? During the fall of 1989, the Sanctity of Life Task Force, together with Lutherans for Life of Illinois and the Northern Illinois District, sponsored a post-abortion syndrome conference for pastors and counselors and laypeople. It was designed as a model seminar to be repeated in whatever area of the country chose to have such a conference. It has been repeated in Missouri and California, and there will be two conferences in Wisconsin next year. I had believed for a long time this was something that was necessary and that post-abortion syndrome was indeed a reality, very different from a loss experienced through miscarriage or through stillbirth. After a while, others became convinced it was probably true, and so we hosted the conference. Two remarkable things took place before my very eyes at that conference. One, some of those who defined post-abortion syndrome as no different from any other pregnancy loss had a change of heart. And second, pastors attending the conference to learn more about counseling the post-aborted woman were given an opportunity to do so on site. As mothers and fathers who had experienced abortion syndrome shared with the group, hearts and minds were open to the very unique and very real grief experienced following an abortion. A lot of our pastors, sad to say, are hesitant to speak about abortion from the pulpit today because they feel that they don't want to stir up painful emotions of the abortion sin and they don't want to offend the woman who might have had an abortion. But if a sinner never confronts the sin, how can forgiveness be received? Not long ago, there was a Lutheran pastor who said he didn't need to address the abortion issue from the pulpit because he knew his congregation very well. And he did not want to speak about post-abortion syndrome. He did not feel it was necessary. But for whatever reason, one Sunday he did choose to speak about abortion, and he did address the healing and the forgiveness that is available to the woman, to the father, to the family who has chosen abortion as a solution. As he was shaking hands after worship that Sunday, two women placed notes of appreciation in his hand, thanking him for addressing the problem that they had experienced following their abortion. And that night he received two more phone calls from yet two more women who had said, thank you. You addressed something that has been giving me a great deal of guilt and pain, and now I know that Jesus can forgive even this sin. This pastor spoke the truth, and yes, he did create some pain, but it was with hope for a new beginning, free of guilt, and with a promise of new life. During this last year, I've been speaking and writing on the effect that abortion has on our society, especially the children. Even though God's Ten Commandments tell us we should not kill, the law of our land says that murder is okay and annually aborts 1.6 million babies. Most abortions, over 95%, are done for reasons of convenience. I know of a good Lutheran father who raised his children with strong moral values, who knew abortion was wrong, but compromised himself when his daughter became pregnant. He paid for her abortion. Our Heavenly Father is different. He doesn't tell us not to kill except in circumstances of inconvenience or social embarrassment. Legalized abortion has already led to practices of euthanasia, or so-called mercy killing. Some children are allowed to starve to death after birth because they don't appear to have a quality of life and because their parents have decided they couldn't raise a handicapped child or a child with Down syndrome. I come from Iowa, the state where, like Missouri and like many of other Midwestern states, we still have the moral values and the good thinking, you know. Well, we're trying to keep up with the East and West Coast, and last year 18 University of Iowa law students wrote an Aid in Dying Act, which basically states that anyone ages 6 and older, not 60, 6 and older, could request a lethal injection should their life become intolerable. These law students used as an example a pianist who loses the use of his hand, cannot play the piano anymore, and figures life is not worth living. This pianist could go before an Aid in Dying board and receive permission to die. At Iowa State University, there is a course now developed for people who would be a telestrician, one who would give permission to die. You all read about Dr. Kevorkian, the doctor who helped Janet Adkins commit suicide in Michigan. In Holland, over 7,000 people a year die through illegal yet acceptable euthanasia practices. And isn't it lovely to know that those doctors from Holland are coming to America to teach our doctors how to successfully perform mercy killings? In the country of Holland, senior citizens are often afraid to go to the hospital to be treated or to have surgery because they might not ever return home. We are slowly being conditioned to think that the old have a duty to die and get out of the way. We make room for the young and the healthy. But what happens when we're not so healthy? It doesn't stop here. A Swedish doctor has proposed that we set up suicide clinics, not to talk people out of it, but to help them do it. If life's just becoming too difficult, why go on living? Can you imagine the message that we are sending to our children? Instead of encouraging them to grow stronger in both character and patience by enduring difficult situations, are we creating a weakened generation where humans can be thrown away when they don't seem to be of any benefit to society? There was a poll taken, some of you might have read it, in Newsweek about a year ago, a poll of New England parents. 6% of those parents said they would abort a child if it would have Alzheimer's later on in life. 11% said they would abort the child likely to be obese. Barbara Bowles of the National Society of Genetic Counselors says that most parents choose to abort babies with Down syndrome because it's so visible. However, parents of a cystic fibrosis child are more likely to give birth because it's not visible. The child looks normal, even though the child will have a short life. As we go about our daily living as Christians in our communities, in our congregations, as you study to become pastors, shepherds of flocks, we all need to believe in the sanctity of life and help dispel the myths. Life did not begin with blind chance. God is the creator of all. Men and women are not, nor will they ever be like God. There is only one God, and there should be no others before him. And the roles of men and women are not interchangeable. Those of you who are married know how different men and women are. I come from a family, my husband and two boys at home. I know we're different. We act different. We look at life differently. We respond differently. God's called us to be different from one another, to harmonize, to share our gifts with each other. But when we fall out of the role that God has for us, the family itself cannot stand, and the children who look to us as role models become confused. Society can boast of sexual equality and freedom, but the backlash is sex without oneness and sex without family. I know in this country, America's bemoaning the high pregnancy rate, especially among our teenagers, but they provide only a band-aid society through sex education. If I had the time, I would explain to you why sex ed isn't working in our schools. American women are crying out for reproductive freedom, but when a child is conceived as a result of that sexual freedom, the mother too often makes a choice to become the mother of a dead child instead of a living child. Soon, America will bemoan the high cost of care for citizens over ages 65, and pressure to legalize euthanasia will become greater. In the meantime, families will be encouraged to compassionately end the suffering of a loved one, all because burden sharing is not comfortable. This is helpless, hopeless, pessimistic, uncreative, and as Christians, we should act and think and be otherwise. We can do this by understanding that we're never going to change the world. We cannot make this into God's kingdom, but we can influence those in this kingdom by our obedience to God's word. This is the time to show and let God tell. Now, most people don't want to kill babies. Therefore, as Christian Lutherans, we want to firmly but gently say to our congregations, to our communities, to our families and friends, we're not talking about abortion rights and government involvement. What we're talking about is one of these. I carry this with me in my purse. You might want to get a copy to carry in your billfold, your pocket. Don't argue. Just talk about what we're discussing here today, the truth, that this is life. We're not talking about government involvement, what's right or what's wrong as far as government is concerned and what our rights are all about. We're talking about a life. We kind of live in a schizophrenic society. Have any of you seen this ad in recent magazine? It's an ad for Volvo magazine. Is something inside telling you to buy a Volvo? You want to look at it later. It's an ultrasound. It's a picture of a baby. I'm not sure why they put this one in here, but it sure shows to me we're talking about life. The other one that is rather interesting is from Dodge. Very pregnant woman, Susan Reed, was in a car accident. If it weren't for the airbag and her seatbelt, she would not have made it. Nor would her baby. It doesn't say her fetus is living now because the airbag saved the life. It says her baby is living now because of the airbag. I would carry some of these around, and this is secular society. It isn't even from a Christian perspective. It's biological. We in the pro-life ministry, through education and outreach in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, are doing nothing any different from the early Christian church. The Christians in Corinth offered charity and mercy and refuge to the temple prostitutes. The Christians in Caesarea cared for the poor and the sick and the lame and the elderly. We're not doing anything any different. We're continuing in the tradition. As we promote chastity education for our youth, and we'll talk about that a little later, as we encourage crisis pregnancy outreach, as we counsel women and families who've had abortions, we are imitating Jesus, building bridges to those who are maybe unlovely, to the prostitutes and the tax collectors and the sinners of all sorts. And we remember Jesus did reserve his harshest comments for those who should know better, for the religious establishment and for his own disciples. Historically, the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church has proclaimed the sanctity of life in convention since 1973. That's why the Sanctity of Life Task Force was formed, to respond to the fact that life is life from conception until natural death, to provide materials, resources, people, to just make people aware, to sensitize our pastors, our teachers, our parents, that life is very special and is from God. We're doing a lot of this through materials that have been published, through Bible studies, videos. We have had seminars. There are a number of materials up here that I'd like you to feel free to take before you leave. And part of what we're doing as a task force through the Board for Social Ministries is to encourage, for example, the Board for Parish Services to do the Bible studies, to prepare the materials for our youth. And I'd like to introduce Rodney Rathman, who does a lot of the editorial work with Board for Parish Services, who has pulled together a lot of the material that Concordia is now publishing that's available to you and to our congregations. Rodney?
As I get started with my part here, perhaps it would be good for me to rehearse for you just a little bit about what the Board for Parish Services is. Board for Parish Services is that agency that Synod, in its bylaws, has given the responsibility to prepare curricular material, Bible studies, and so on, in conjunction with Concordia Publishing House, and is in that capacity, then, that I serve and am here today. Before I talk about resources, I'd just like to underscore a couple of things that Linda said. She made reference to post-abortion syndrome, and I too was privileged to attend that post-abortion syndrome convocation that was held in Chicago last spring. I'm nearsighted, so I sit up front generally, and at the end of that day, a two-day experience, I was about as exhausted as I've ever been in my life. That was a most eye-opening experience for me. When we talk about ministering to someone, both men and women who suffer because of abortion, there are some interesting things that I think pastors and those of us who are involved with Christian counseling need to keep in mind. And the people who did the major presenting at this conference were not Lutheran. They were doctor and doctor, husband and wife, Susan and Vincent Rue. And they talked about how when counseling someone who grieves because of an abortion, you need to, first of all, as Linda articulated, confront them with the sin, and then help them work through the grief as you apply the gospel. Now, it would have seemed to me, in advance to attending that, that someone who already suffers because of an abortion is ready to hear the gospel. But they underlined the need to actually look at abortion for what it is. Another thing that Linda pointed out, and I'd like to underscore, is we're just beginning to see the effect that living in a world where abortion is promoted, how that is affecting our children. A couple of weeks ago, there was at Concordia Maplewood the second annual Lutherans for Life banquet, and some of the seminarians from here were in attendance. It was a nice turnout. Our speaker was Dr. Jean Garten, and she was talking about some of the effects of abortion on children in society today, and she talked about speaking in a congregation in Michigan. And seated in the front was a little girl. A woman was sitting beside her, who Dr. Garten assumed was her mother. And the little girl asked her during the course of her presentation, "Why wasn't I aborted?" And Jean Garten said, "Well, that just really took me back. But of course, in those times, the Holy Spirit gives you the words to say." And she said something like, "Well, God had a plan for you." Then later on, the woman who was sitting next to the little girl came up and said, "You know, I'm so glad you answered this girl's question the way you did. I'm her stepmother. This girl has just lived with us for the past year or so. Before that, she lived with her mother. And her mother would always say to her things like, 'You know, I aborted those two other kids. I wish to God I would have aborted you too.'" It's a sad comment, but that kind of thinking is out there, and we're just beginning to see its effects now. A couple of weeks ago, I was also privileged to attend a euthanasia conference that was sponsored by, interestingly enough, the Nurses Association of Missouri. And one of the remarkable things from that day was a young man, I think he was perhaps a doctor or maybe a male nurse. He talked in broken English. He was from Holland, where, as Linda mentioned, the laws relative to life issues are very liberal. And he traced for the group the history of what had happened in Holland, and he said when his grandfather was very ill during the late 60s, he and his family lamented the fact that he could not be allowed peacefully to be let go, that he could not be given an injection. And he talked about how initially society was repulsed at that, but then gradually there became an acceptance. And he said what turned things around for him was when he became a Christian, and then overnight he saw things differently. And for me, the whole life issue and everything surrounding it is very simple. Linda and I coming over here, I always enjoy talking to Linda because Linda is a farmer's wife, and I enjoy very much my farm heritage and growing up on a farm, and like to reminisce about life as I saw it there, my experiences with life and death growing up in that environment. But the fact that human life is special, I think, goes back to Romans 5:8. "While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." That gives all human life a value. And now that he has died for us and we live as his redeemed children, we can hold on to passages like 1 John 1:3, "See what love the Father has for us, that we should be called the children of God." And so we are. And because of that, then, we have the obligation and the privilege and the responsibility to take a stand on life issues. In the brief amount of time that I have here, and I'm going to do this quickly, I'm going to point out some of the things that the Board for Parish Services is doing in its curricular materials to help underscore the value that God would have us place on human life. And I think when we think about curriculum and what needs to be included in curriculum, and first of all, curriculum, as you know, is such an amorphic kind of a term. What, after all, does it mean? But when we think about life issues and curriculum, one of the things I want to point out to you is how that is integral to every aspect of what we're doing in parish services. For example, you're probably aware, right now we are actually just a few months away from a new catechism, which will be coming out. And that new catechism will have in it specific references to life issues, such as abortion and euthanasia. I don't have any copies of the accompanying piece to show you today, but I did bring a sample of it. This is a manuscript form. It's down at the publishing house right now. And this is a sample from either the lesson dealing with the fifth commandment or the sixth, and I'll just read a portion of it with you. The curriculum that we produce is, of course, Bible-based, Christ-centered, and life-applicable, and this is the life application for those commandments. Charlene and Bill have been going steady for over 2 years. Charlene just discovered she's 2 months pregnant. Charlene and Bill really like each other, but neither of them feel they are ready for marriage. Charlene is active in her church, but Bill is into sports and feels the church is just a waste of time. Neither of them want a baby. He's 17, she's 16. Bill suggests that everything will be okay if Charlene gets an abortion, but she believes that by having an abortion, she would be killing an innocent human life. Bill says, it's just a fetus. Get rid of it like you would an unwanted wart. And then there are questions that lead them into the Bible and help them to interact with that particular case study. Here's a Sunday school lesson that does much the same thing. This is a junior high lesson. Right now we also have available from CPH some mini courses. These are 4 sessions in length. They're targeted for use at the junior high level, in day schools, weekday schools, Sunday schools. This particular one is called Managing My Life, and it has one of the 4 sessions dealing with sexuality, God-pleasing sexuality. That's targeted for junior high. Judging by the sales at CPH, it's being widely used. This is a course that is targeted for high schoolers. It's called Valuing Your Sexuality, and I want to just tell you a little bit of what's behind the conception of this particular piece. When we had the Lutherans for Life convention here, I believe it was the winter, January of 88, there was a group from a high school in Wisconsin that made a presentation on sex respect, curricular material targeted for the public school that stresses chastity. Some of us in attendance at that particular workshop were so excited about this, we thought, wouldn't it be neat if we could put together a curriculum of our own, adapting this material, but teaching it from the gospel perspective. During the months and weeks that followed, we corresponded with Kent Mast, who is the manager for Sex Respect. And while this was going on, we thought to ourselves, wow, how much money do we have to put into this? But I decided to be brave enough to ask him if we could use the material for nothing and adapt it. And thank the Lord, he allowed us to use it for nothing, seeing it as a promotion for his piece, for his work. It really is not. It's an adaptation of it. But it's here, it's available for use. It's 10 sessions. It really is a chastity course aimed at skills. How do you handle dating as a skill? It points out the sexual differences between men and women, boys and girls, and how those differences can get people into trouble. And it does it very well, I think, in 10 sessions, providing skills, including some practical things like accepting a challenge for your life, and that ties in, of course, to one of the basic human needs of teens, that need to face a challenge and meet it. Includes practical tips like not going on a date alone, but group dating, pointing out the values of that and so on. This is a high school course which is being adapted for use in other arenas like Sunday school, high school youth, and so on. It's called Choices, Choices, Choices. has some sessions on the back, in the back of it, that deal specifically with abortion and euthanasia. Perhaps the most pertinent to our discussion here this morning is this one called For Life, written by Janet Robson. It's four sessions dealing with the issue of abortion. The first session talks about life and the value that God has for human life and the value that He would have us have. The second session deals specifically with abortion. The third session deals with ministering to those who suffer because of abortion. And the fourth session deals with political involvement. And by the way, since I've been involved in Lutherans for Life, it's been interesting for me to come in contact with folks who are from other denominations, specifically non-Catholic denominations, who say, I am so much in admiration of the stand that your synod has taken regarding this issue. And we're very, very proud of this course, too. I might mention at this juncture that right now in the hopper, we have a adult Bible study that is six sessions long, written by Dr. John Klotz from here at the seminary, and it deals with bioethical issues, abortion, euthanasia, organ transplants, suicide, in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, surrogate motherhood, in six sessions. And that's down at the house and should be available shortly this fall, next fall. Also, of course, we have this piece, which is our very popular Concordia Sex Education series. It's available on six levels and includes a parent guide, how to talk about your child at whatever age he or she is. We also have another, this is a set of mini courses that's already been bound. It's the Life Cycle course. It is a five-component piece that deals with the specific challenges that one has at each of the different life stages, beginning with young adulthood and going on into the twilight years. That's five levels, four sessions each. And then I wanted to mention to you also a couple of things that are available to you free. This is available from ABS, American Bible Society. I just became aware of it yesterday. The librarian at Synod brought it over. It's called Life in All of Its Fullness. And it's mainly Bible, compiled together by the folks from the American Bible Society. Every Lutheran school in Synod should have one of these. They were made available to our Lutheran schools through the generosity of Lutheran Charities Foundation here in St. Louis. And this is an AIDS instructional materials kit. And, of course, it has an obvious tie into what we're talking about here today regarding life issues. It includes a six-part video. It has a high school component, an elementary component, and then a component that you could use to talk to a parent group. The video was put together by Synod's Board for Communication Services. It's very well done, I think. It gives you a real Lutheran feel as you watch it for the Lutheran ministry to those who suffer in any way because of the whole AIDS plague in our society. And as I mentioned, of course, this would be free from American Bible Society, I believe free or available at a minimum, but this is free to all Lutheran schools. Okay, President Kuhn. I'd like to introduce you and give you a couple little opportunity to speak. I know that you have to be on your way shortly. So,
thanks much, Rodney, and thanks to you for being here this morning, and thank you for letting me have a few minutes of your time on a very busy day. When Linda and I talked about the possibility of being here this morning, I suggested that maybe it would be good for me to have the opportunity to say that you're going to encounter some of these things, many of these things, most of these things, and probably all of these things in your parish ministry. It's hard for me to come back to these hallowed halls, Dr. Johnson, and not think of books being in here, because when I was here 47 or 89 years ago, I can't remember how many it was, this was all books. And so to come back today and see the totally empty of books, it seems very strange. But back in the 60s, April 1963, call services were a little bit different than they are today. But we received our calls in the chapel auditorium, and I mean, we had the service there, and then we had to go off to one of the other rooms, and we got that piece of paper, and I opened it up. And at the same time, I was carrying an atlas of the United States in my arm because they hadn't told me I was going to a foreign land, so I thought I was going to be in the United States and I was going to be safe. My fiancée was walking beside me. I opened the envelope, and lo and behold, it said, Bath, Illinois. Well, that didn't bother me too much until I opened up the atlas. The United States found Illinois, couldn't find Bath. It was installed a couple of months later, and about 3 months after installation, I had two families from the congregation sitting in my study, not talking with each other to begin with, and then fighting with each other almost literally, because they were ready to go to court against each other over some blowing sand from one person's property over onto another individual's house. And the thought struck me, Lord, why didn't Harry Koiner tell me something about this when I was in pastoral theology? How do I handle it? What do I do and where do I go? Isn't there something such as a resource that an individual would be able to look to for something that Fritz didn't talk about? You might not go to Bath, Illinois, but you might go to Zap, North Dakota. Unfortunately, the seminary trains us to be involved in some kind of a parish situation where there's either going to be a school or at least multi-staff, and you're assured that you're going to have a secretary and all those other things, and then you end up either at Bath, Illinois, or Zap, North Dakota, with a mimeograph that came over with Columbus, or a movie projector that really doesn't even have a manual with it anymore. And of course, we're far beyond that. But I think you get the message that you need something to say, how in the world am I going to deal with whatever it might be at your particular parish? Believe me, you're going to deal with abortion. You're going to deal with euthanasia. You're going to deal with post-abortion syndrome. You're going to deal with AIDS. You're going to deal with numerous couples living together without being married. You're going to deal again and again and again and again with teenage pregnancies. And you're going to deal again and again and again with the whole matter of chastity of life. Now, I sound like one of those old guys. Professor Eichmann and I were classmates, and you know how old you think he is, so now you know how old I am. These things are not just something that pastoral theology profs are saying, well, you may encounter, and we would like to have you ready for, just in case, but you probably won't have to deal with. You will deal with all of these items. You will deal with hurting people who will be coming to you and saying, what do we do and how do we handle this? And the bottom line, people, is there really forgiveness for that which is wrong? I'm pleading with you as you either finish up in year 4, as you're getting ready in year 2 for vicarage, or if you happen to be in year 1 in vicarage and final call still seems very far away, I'm pleading with you to take these matters as being real. When the prof discusses them in pastoral theology, he's not just off in some foreign land as far as his thinking is concerned. It's right here in this country where the vast majority of you will ultimately be serving. One thing that's up here on the table, and this is not a commercial and I'm not selling it, it's free and it's over there and there's a pretty good stack. It's called Social Ministry Planning Manual and Sanctity of Life Module. In the back are some resource recommendations. A new one's going to come out. We haven't been told exactly when it's going to come, but a new one is going to come out. And when it becomes available, please take hold of that so that when you get to Bath, Illinois, or Zap, North Dakota, you're going to have the opportunity to look for resources on your own to be able to know how to deal with some of the things that you will be encountering as far as your pastoral ministry is concerned. When you leave these hallowed walls, when you leave the security of this campus, when you leave the synthetic-ness of society as it exists during seminary days, because you're not out there 100% of the time dealing with all of real life, be sure to take with you your Bible. Be sure to take with you your copy of Tappert, and by that time there might be a whole new one out. Be sure to take with you some form of pastoral theology. And even though it's old and ancient, Fritz still isn't all that bad. Take with you some type of doctrinal reference. Could even be Pieper if the new one's not out yet. Even take with you your copy of Nesper, because you got to have all those biblical texts. But take also some kind of a resource guide for dealing with life issues like abortion and euthanasia and AIDS, and we could go on and on and on. You will be dealing with them. I did, and the men in the Central Illinois District are dealing with them at a more rapid rate than I ever dreamed of when I was in parish ministry. And so as you leave this place, and as you go to serve God's people on a full-time basis, may He give you strength, may He give you wisdom, may He give you knowledge, and may He give you the determination that you're not going to compromise your confession, but you will be able to say, yes, that's what God has said, and this is what I'm sharing with you, friend, but I will help you work through it. Even though you're struggling, I will help you to work through your problem so that you can live in accord with God's will. God's blessings to you, and thank you this morning for your time.
Life encourages their members to be active legislatively and to make a difference with the law. But Lutherans for Life as a whole, and being a church organization, believes that the law isn't going to make the difference. It will be the changing of hearts and minds. And so it's purely, as far as Lutherans for Life is concerned, a biblical, educational matter. Again, though, we do encourage our people to be active politically, to vote, to get out there and know what's happening in the country and make a difference that way, but we still think it's a hearts and mind kind of thing. And that's why we do encourage right to life involvement among our people, too. But Lutherans for Life is really sharing biblical information, educational things for our kids and for our parents and teachers and pastors.
I don't know whether the exhibit is still over at the Art Museum, but recently at least there was one featuring the achievements of black women in American society. Interesting. And one kind of brought me up short. I wish I had, I copied down a part of, alongside the portrait of a woman, a black woman, and a St. Louis black woman. And then there would be something about their life and something of what they said. And this woman began part of what she had there. I know of no women who think it's a great idea to have an abortion. And then the thing that kind of brought me up short was, she said, if you people are all that serious about the sanctity of life, how come there are so many unadopted black children? Do we have an answer?
From what I'm hearing, I just recently worked with a pregnant black mom from Milwaukee. She was going to junior college in our town and wanted to have the baby, did not want to abort, returned to Milwaukee, and I think is probably going to raise the child because most black families keep their children. They do not want to place them for adoption. They feel that that is giving the child away would be the same as abortion, and they really are very family-oriented and want to raise the child, be it a good situation or not. From what I've heard in the state of Wisconsin, there are not that many black children available for adoption, although there is a list of people waiting to adopt children of any color. I don't know if that answers your question, but there are waiting lists, and people are either, and for handicapped children, for Down syndrome children. The baby Doe in Indiana that was allowed to die a few years ago, there were parents calling in wanting to adopt that child, knowing the circumstances, but the parents of the child, the birth parents, would not allow it.
So our answer to this lady would be, you don't want to give your children, black children, up for adoption.
Again, the understanding that I have among the black community and the Hispanic communities, they really cherish their children and do not even want to comprehend giving a child away. Whether or not they should, they want to keep that child. They may not be raising it in the best of circumstances, but it's hard for them to let go. And so there is not a long list of black children available.
It seems to me that I recall seeing, although I don't look at television very much, that they were holding up some black babies and praising them and kind of holding them up for adoption. But anyway, thank you. That gives me something to think about.
Anything else?
John?
If you had one idea or one word to tell someone, like one of us or a friend or something who's going to counsel women who come in with maybe a crisis pregnancy or are in that stage of ambivalence, to keep in mind when we're talking to them, what would it be?
I would have to say a Christ kind of love. Keeping your eyes and your ears open to the pain she's going to be sharing. Being there as a friend, letting her do the talking, offering the compassionate kind of love you know Jesus would have offered and does offer. Not being judgmental, but then offering to walk with her through that. And if not yourself, have someone there, someone in the congregation, in the community, who would be a friend to her. I think more of them are wanting a friend than anything else. Someone who will say, yes, you made the right choice to not abort. Now here's somebody to go through it with you. Being a friend.
Anything else? Now, I assume they can pick up some of this material and... Oh, there's one more. Dr. Huffman.
Mr. Ratner, good question. Is there any thinking that my rationality could give me for why the Concordia Sex Education series is held so high in all circles that I'm aware of in Christendom except the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod?
Except the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod?
My understanding is that it's not used as, with
Yes, it's very well regarded, even in secular circles. I think we simply have a reluctance on the part of people, pastors, lay people, to touch that subject. It's not an easy one to talk about. Even as parents, I remember when I had to give that talk. I really had to gird my loins, you know, and go into that thing. This is another example. This is a Bible study called Sexuality, A Christian Perspective, and it's not widely used. I was just talking to someone recently who was using it with a class, and he said it was fun to teach, but boy, you really have to develop intimacy with the group on that subject. So I think that's probably the answer.
I just wanted to thank all of you for coming and making this presentation. I think the World Mission Institute should buy tapes and put them in all of our students' mailboxes so that the fruit of the message would, you know, be distributed wider. When I think of mission and when I think of making the Christian faith relevant to the many nowadays in our country who think it's irrelevant. As I listen to Linda, here is the basics, you know. And as we would evangelize, our message is not indeed divorced from life, and we're not dealing with souls with ears and whatever, but as our people all around us are concerned with life, meaning of life, and their own identity and all of these things, this particular issue packages a contact point that's a real live issue throughout our whole society for the entire law gospel presentation. And that awareness should make us, it is more than simply the issue of helping people work through some sin or some issue, but it is the issue of being Christian versus non-Christian itself and the whole mission of the church. So I thank you for that.
It sounds very much like our biggest enemy is ignorance. How's the best way to deal with that?
I think, first of all of you should be Lutherans for Life members, because when you are, then you will get the newsletters, the mailings, the tracts, have available to you the Bible studies and the information. I know you read so many things. I'm reading more serious stuff all the time. I was telling Rodney, you can't even sit down and read anything fun anymore because you have to stay up with all that's happening. Being a parent, I'm well aware of that. But I would say that's a first step. Then you at least have in your mail the information. When you have time to read it, pick it up. The things that we are putting out in the individual states with Lutherans for Life are amazing. The different curriculums, the materials for the kids that the parents should be reading. The Living Magazine, short articles that can be easily read quickly, but that touch on those things that you probably need to be up on. What I do with Paper Treasures are tracts for teens. I don't think it probably would hurt if parents and our future shepherds of our congregations would have those available just to read once in a while. The quick little things. You don't have to sit down and read a whole great big book anymore. The little things are out there.
If I could just add to that, I think in times past it was possible for somebody to go through our Lutheran schools, our Lutheran parochial schools, and never be told that abortion was wrong. And I'm going to be 38 in a couple of weeks. I know people my age that don't know personally someone who has gone through an abortion. I think if you conduct an informal survey among high schoolers, you will not find that to be the case. They will know classmates that will have had one or more abortions. So to tie in with what Linda said, I think the Lutherans for Life focus on education is a very important one, and certainly one that we're trying to address in all of our curriculum materials.
With that, I think the worst thing to do is nothing. In other words, there's going to be a very real temptation to avoid or evade and think that maybe the problem's going to go away, no matter what the issue is, whether it's euthanasia with a person or whether it's abortion or whatever. Let's not deal with it. Let's not deal with teenage pregnancy. Let's not talk about it, and maybe I won't have to ever confront it. And that's the worst thing that you can do for yourself, but especially for other individuals. You've got to deal with it, and you've got to do it really right now.
Well, our time has passed, and we...